Imagine a drug so powerfully effective at treating severe trauma that a staggering 71% of patients essentially no longer qualify for a PTSD diagnosis after just a few sessions.
I mean, that is just a massive number in psychiatry.
Right, it's huge. And then the FDA completely rejects it. But meanwhile, a psychedelic mushroom compound that fundamentally dissolves your sense of self is getting fast-tracked by the White House.
Yeah, welcome to the totally upside-down world of modern psychiatry.
It's wild. Today, we are pulling from this fascinating, honestly, incredibly detailed June 2026 article from the OTW Journal.
Oh, yeah, the one titled MDMA versus psilocybin, a neuroscience comparison.
That's the one. And our mission for this deep dive is to clear up the massive confusion between these two specific molecules. We're going to unpack the hard science of how they uniquely rewire our brains to target, entirely different mental health crises.
Right, because they are doing very different things.
Exactly. And we'll also explore their dramatic, highly controversial paths in the 2026 legal landscape.
And just to set the stakes for you as we dive in, trauma and depression are not the same wound.
No, not at all.
Yet historically, modern psychiatry has tried to patch them up with the exact same tools, usually SSRI antidepressants and standard talk therapy.
Which, I mean, sometimes that helps partially, but often it leaves people completely stranded.
Right. So this deep dive is about understanding a completely bifurcated approach. We are talking about two entirely different keys cut for two entirely different locks.
And as always, just a quick disclaimer up front. We are exploring the science and the research today for educational purposes. This is, not medical advice.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack this because everything downstream, all the differing therapy models, the political drama, the FDA decisions, it all starts with the molecules themselves.
Right. At the basic chemical level.
Yeah, and the source material makes it incredibly clear right out of the gate. MDMA and psilocybin do not belong in the same bucket.
They don't.
Yeah.
They belong to completely different pharmacological classes. MDMA is what we call an empathogen, whereas psilocybin is a classic serotonergic psychedelic.
So let's start with MDMA and kind of look under the hood at the neuroscience here. The core concept is that MDMA is a monoamine releaser.
Right.
And its central trick, which is honestly brilliant in a biochemical way, is how it interacts with the serotonin transporter in your brain.
Which is known as SERT.
Right, SERT. Normally, SERT operates like this highly efficient vacuum cleaner. After your brain uses serotonin to send a signal across a synapse, SERT vacuums up the leftover serotonin so the neuron can recycle it.
But when MDMA enters the neuron through that exact same vacuum cleaner, it does something highly unusual.
Right, the reversal thing.
Exactly. It actually reverses the direction of the pump. It turns the vacuum cleaner into a leaf blower.
That is such a crazy image.
It really is. So instead of reclaiming serotonin, it forcefully floods the synapse with it, along with a massive rush of dopamine and norepinephrine.
And the chemistry doesn't even stop there, right? Because MDMA also triggers a significant release of oxytocin, which we widely know as the bonding hormone.
Yes, the cuddle hormone, some people call it.
Yeah. And the felt, subjective result of all this cascading chemistry is what gives empathogens their name. The patient experiences this profound sense of warmth, trust, emotional openness, and crucially, a striking reduction in defensiveness and fear.
And that reduction in fear is the absolute therapeutic hinge here.
How so?
Well, when researchers look at neuroimaging and animal models under the influence of MDMA, they see actively dampened activity in the amygdala and the insula.
Okay, and those are your brain's fear and threat salience hubs.
Exactly. They're the biological alarm bells that just constantly ring for someone with severe PTSD. MDMA essentially unplugs the alarm.
Wow. Okay, so now consider psilocybin, which arrives at the brain from a completely different direction.
Right. Once you ingest psilocybin and your body metabolizes it into its active form, which is psilocin, it doesn't just flood the brain with stored neurotransmitters like MDMA does.
So it's not a leaf blower.
No, not at all. Instead, it is a 5-HT2A receptor agonist. It acts like a highly specific key, turning on a particular serotonin receptor that is densely packed in the cortex of the brain.
And when you turn on that specific receptor, it triggers what the article calls neural entropy,
Yes, entropy.
which, for anyone who isn't a neuroscientist, think of your brain's usual neural pathways as a snow globe where all the flakes have settled firmly on the bottom in these rigid frozen
I
patterns.
love that analogy.
Yeah, and psilocybin basically picks up the snow globe and shakes it violently. It desynchronizes the brain. And most importantly, it loosens a network called the default mode network, or the DMN.
Right, and the DMN is essentially your brain's autopilot. It is this tightly coupled circuit responsible for your sense of self, your ego, and for a lot of people struggling with severe mental health issues. It's responsible for rigid self-referential rumination.
It's that voice in your head that keeps looping the exact same hopeless thoughts over and over again. It sounds like MDMA lowers the drawbridge of a heavily guarded castle so you can safely step inside, while psilocybin dissolves the castle walls entirely so you can see the whole landscape.
That is a perfect way to visualize it.
But wait, hold on. I'm struggling to buy this a little bit. Oh. Are we saying that just reversing a serotonin pump or turning on a receptor for a few hours on a Tuesday permanently cures 20 years of trauma or depression?
It does sound like a stretch when you put it like that.
Right. It sounds like magic, not science. Like, what is actually making it permanent?
Well, what's fascinating here is the honest caveat from our source.
Mm-hmm.
The answer to your question is that the science is not entirely settled.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The stories we are telling about fear memory reconsolidation for MDMA and the entropy and plasticity story for psilocybin, they are compelling, well-supported hypotheses.
Okay, hypotheses, not proven facts.
Exactly. Much of this causal chain is inferred from animal models and brain imaging correlations. No one can yet map the exact millimeter-by-millimeter chain of how a molecular event today becomes durable, lifelong psychological relief tomorrow. We have to treat these as very strong working models.
So what does this all mean for the actual patient experience? Because these molecules leave a patient in such radically vulnerable states, you can't just hand them a prescription bottle and say, you know, take one daily with food.
No, absolutely not. The physical environment has to do half the heavy lifting.
Right. How does the clinical room actually look for someone undergoing these therapies?
They're engineered for two entirely different therapeutic containers. The MDMA model is purpose-built for PTSD. It typically involves two or three active dosing sessions of roughly 80 to 125 milligrams.
And those are spaced out, right?
Yeah, these active sessions are spaced several weeks apart and usually have two co-therapists in the room with you for an entire 8-hour day.
8 hours. Wow. And the goal inside that room is fear memory reconsolidation. Because the MDMA has quieted the amygdala, the patient is given this temporary window of reduced fear.
Right, the alarm is unplugged.
So they can actually pull the traumatic memory out of their mental filing cabinet, look at it, process it with their therapists without being thrown into a blinding panic attack, and then put that memory back into the filing cabinet without the overwhelming fear attached to it.
Exactly. It uses drug-induced safety to approach a specific, previously intolerable memory and make it tolerable.
And psilocybin is totally different.
Yeah, the psilocybin therapy model targets a different kind of suffering entirely. It's for treatment-resistant depression and the existential end-of-life distress we see in terminal illnesses.
The clinical setup for psilocybin is usually just a single, roughly 25 milligram, full-day supervised session.
Right.
But instead of actively talking through a specific trauma with two therapists, like with MDMA, the patient is typically wearing eye shades, listening to carefully curated instrumental music, with trained monitors simply holding space for them in silence.
Because psilocybin isn't about approaching a specific fear. It's about a broad perceptual shift. It's about shaking that snow globe to break the hopeless, self-critical patterns nested in the default mode network. It's about meaning-making rather than fear reduction.
Given how incredibly well-tailored both of these treatments are to their specific psychiatric targets, you know, you might assume they are racing toward the finish line of federal approval side by side.
You would think so.
But as of mid-2026, their paths have taken a massive historical divergence. The clinical scoreboard between the two is just a stark contrast.
Yeah, let's look at the raw data for MDMA first. The drug sponsor, Lykos Therapeutics, ran two major phase 3 trials, known as MAPP1 and MAPP2.
And the results were published in Nature Medicine.
Right. And in MAPP2, the results were astounding. A full 71% of the MDMA group no longer met the diagnostic criteria for PTSD by the end of the trial, compared to 48% on placebo.
Here's where it gets really interesting. With an effect size that huge, arguably the strongest in the history of PTSD pharmacotherapy, how on earth could the FDA possibly justify slamming the brakes on approval?
Well, the FDA process is about much more than just the raw efficacy numbers. It's about the fundamental integrity of the trial itself. In August 2024, the FDA issued a complete response letter.
Which is basically a rejection.
Essentially, yes. They declined to approve MDMA-assisted therapy and demanded another full phase 3 trial.
And the reasons detailed by the FDA were significant, starting with something called functional unblinding.
Right. In a gold standard clinical trial, you want half the people to get the experimental drug and half to get a placebo, and nobody is supposed to know which they got.
That's how you prove the drug actually works independently of the placebo effect.
Exactly. But with MDMA, nearly every patient and therapist could instantly tell who had received the active drug.
I mean, you can't really fake a profound 8-hour rush of oxytocin, empathy, and dilated pupils.
You really can't. And that functional unblinding completely undermined the FDA's confidence in the statistical comparison between the groups.
Plus, there were other issues, right?
Yeah. Combine that structural flaw with some serious allegations regarding therapist conduct and boundary violations at certain trial sites, and the entire application just stalled.
And the fallout was devastating. Mm-hmm. Lykos Therapeutics had to cut roughly 75% of its staff just to regroup and focus on running the new requested trial. It pushed federal approval years down the road.
But while MDMA stumbled, psilocybin has been on an absolute winning streak.
Yeah, Compass Pathways nailed not one, but two phase 3 trials for treatment-resistant depression. That's COMP005 in 2025 and COMP006 in February 2026.
Which marked the first time any classic psychedelic had completed successful phase 3 trials. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the regulatory landscape shifted dramatically in April 2026.
The White House got involved.
They did. The White House issued Executive Order 11401, directing federal agencies to actively accelerate access to psychedelic therapies that had successfully completed phase 3 trials.
And just days later, the FDA announced priority review vouchers specifically for psilocybin programs, putting them on a highly compressed, fast-track timeline for full approval.
Meanwhile, because MDMA failed its phase 3 review, its eligibility under that executive order is heavily contested. It's effectively been left behind.
The FDA's hesitancy around MDMA brings up a critical factor for you, the listener, to understand: safety. When dealing with deeply powerful compounds, we tend to categorize things simply as safe or dangerous.
Right, as a binary.
But the source material makes a crucial point. These two drugs carry drastically different hazard curves. They are risky in completely opposite directions.
We often want to rank risks on a single, clean scale. But comparing the dangers of these two is like comparing the risks of redlining a car engine to the risks of rewriting the car's software while you're driving it down the highway.
Hey, I love that. So they threaten entirely different systems. Let's start with MDMA. That's redlining the engine.
Yes.
Its sharpest risks are acute and physical. Because it's a powerful stimulant and a monoamine releaser, it puts serious physical stress on the hardware.
It raises your heart rate, your blood pressure, and your core body temperature.
And in uncontrolled recreational settings, like hot, crowded music festivals, you see real risks of hyperthermia, which is dangerous, sometimes fatal overheating.
You also see a terrifying condition called hyponatremia.
That's dangerously low blood sodium. But why would a serotonin-releasing drug cause your blood sodium to drop?
Well, MDMA triggers the release of vasopressin. Vasopressin is an antidiuretic hormone. It basically tells your kidneys to hold on to water and stop producing urine.
Oh, I see.
So if a person is dancing in a hot room, sweating, and aggressively drinking excess water because they feel hot, their body can't clear the fluid. The water accumulates and dilutes the sodium in their bloodstream to life-threatening levels, which can lead to brain swelling and seizures.
God, that's awful. And we also have to talk about the drug interactions, which are severe.
Highly severe. If you combine MDMA with other serotonergic medications, it can cause a fatal condition called serotonin syndrome. It simply overloads the nervous system.
We are talking about interactions with SSRIs, which are common daily antidepressants, or MAOIs, which are older antidepressants that essentially block the enzyme that cleans up serotonin in the brain.
Right. If you mix an MAOI with MDMA, you are trapping a massive flood of serotonin in the brain with no way for the body to break it down.
Which is why clinical protocols require patients to carefully taper off certain psychiatric medications before they can even sit for an MDMA session.
Exactly. The source also touches on the long-standing debate around MDMA neurotoxicity, you know, the fear that it causes permanent damage to serotonin pathways or cognitive deficits.
What does the data say about that now?
It frames this very fairly, that risk is overwhelmingly linked to heavy, repeated recreational use over years. When you are looking at the controlled, single-digit number of moderate doses used in clinical therapy, that risk appears to be vastly lower. The toxicity is highly dependent on the dose and the pattern of use.
So MDMA is redlining the physical engine. Psilocybin, on the other hand, is rewriting the software.
Right.
The physical hardware is mostly fine. Your heart isn't overheating. You aren't retaining water. But if the navigation system crashes, you panic. The signature hazard of psilocybin is the profoundly psychological bad trip.
Because you are fundamentally altering your consciousness. That can bring up overwhelming anxiety, ontological shock, or pure terror.
But in a supervised clinical setting with trained monitors holding space, that transient panic is manageable and often therapeutically useful.
Exactly. But without support, it can be deeply destabilizing for a person.
Physically, though, psilocybin doesn't carry the same acute physiological dangers. It might cause temporary spikes in blood pressure or heart rate, but nothing remotely close to the hyperthermia risk of MDMA.
There is a theoretical heart valve risk linked to the 5-HTDB receptor, but evidence currently shows it's really only a concern for chronic frequent use.
Like someone daily microdosing over several years.
Right, not occasional supervised therapy sessions.
Yeah.
However, the medical community draws a very firm line in the sand regarding psychological safety.
The absolute contraindications.
Yes. Anyone with a personal or family history of psychosis, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder is firmly contraindicated for psilocybin.
Why is that?
The very mechanism that makes it work, increasing neural entropy and dissolving rigid networks, can precipitate prolonged psychotic or manic episodes in vulnerable populations. You do not want to shake the snow globe if the glass is already fragile.
That makes total sense. So neither drug is simply the safe one. They just target entirely different vulnerabilities.
That's exactly.
Because of these differing hazard profiles and their divergent FDA statuses, the reality of trying to access these therapies as a patient today in 2026 is incredibly lopsided. Let's map out the current geography here.
Okay.
Both of these drugs remain Schedule I at the federal level, meaning the DEA still categorizes them as having no accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. But state-level access is a mismatched patchwork.
Because psilocybin has successfully forged several live legal pathways at the state level.
Right. Look at Oregon. Oregon launched a supported adult use model. They have licensed psilocybin service centers for adults over 21, deliberately kept outside the traditional medical and psychiatric systems.
And then you have Colorado, right, which licenses clinical healing centers under its Natural Medicine Health Act.
And New Mexico is currently building a strictly medical program, expected to take its first patients by late 2026, specifically targeting things like treatment-resistant depression. So if I'm a patient in one of those states, I can seek out a supervised psilocybin experience right now. But what if I have severe debilitating PTSD and I desperately need MDMA? Can I go to a clinic in Colorado for that?
This raises an important question, and it really reveals a profound irony in the current landscape. Despite MDMA having arguably the strongest raw efficacy data for treating PTSD in psychiatric history, it has zero state pathway.
None. Yeah.
It was explicitly excluded from Colorado's natural medicine framework because it is a synthetic compound, not a naturally occurring plant or fungi.
Wow. So outside of ongoing, tightly controlled clinical trials, the only way to get MDMA legally right now is through federal expanded access or compassionate use channel,
which are notoriously difficult to navigate. So practically speaking, the drug with the 71% success rate for trauma is currently much harder to access than the psychedelic mushroom.
We've covered a massive amount of ground today. We've looked at the molecular mechanics of how these drugs rewire the brain, the high-stakes trials that tested them, the unique physiological versus psychological risks they carry, and the complicated legal webs they are caught in today.
It's a lot to process.
It is. But bringing this all together for you, the listener, the core takeaway from the OOTW Journal source is this. This isn't a competition. We aren't trying to crown a winner between MDMA and psilocybin.
No, it is entirely about finding the right key for the specific lock. It is about matching the mechanism to the exact suffering a patient is experiencing.
If the target is PTSD, if the problem is a specific localized traumatic memory guarded by an overwhelming wall of biological fear, MDMA is the key. Its pharmacology is purpose-built to quiet that fear, unplug the alarm, and allow the patient to heal the memory.
But if the target is treatment-resistant depression or existential distress, if the problem is a mind trapped in rigid, hopeless, self-critical loops, psilocybin is the key.
Right. It shakes the snow globe and loosens the network to let new meaning take root.
I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on, building on the conclusion of our source material. As our understanding of brain imaging and biomarkers improves, what happens when psychiatry stops diagnosing people based on subjective checklists of symptoms.
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Imagine a future where a doctor doesn't ask you to fill out a 10-point questionnaire about your mood, but instead looks at an fMRI scan of your literal neural network.
Wow.
Imagine a clinician looking at that scan and simply saying, "Your mind is too rigid. I'm prescribing entropy." Or, "Your mind is too afraid. I'm prescribing connection."
That is an incredible vision for the future of medicine, getting as far away as possible from that blunt instrument approach we started with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the neuroscience of tomorrow. Keep questioning the consensus, keep exploring the science, and we'll catch you next time.